From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson alongside Megan Mack, who just flew in from California.
And I have a beautiful
boy,
tan.
Are her arms tired. It's so bad.
Womp, womp.
It's so bad. I've got to try to start on a light note and end on a light note because we've got some heavy stuff this week. And so I kind of want to warn you about our first clip, which is, I don't know, Megan, harsh is the term I put in the script. I don't know if harsh is the term. It's just a very direct thought experiment, isn't it? It's kind of hard to listen to.
It is, and that's one of the shows that I listen to, Catching Up, and it took me by surprise. I think it's thought-provoking, and I'm glad we included it in the podcast.
Well, Paul Chappell is the guy here. Paul Chappell is an Iraq War veteran. He's an author, and his daily work involves achieving peace in the nuclear age. He was in Rochester as a guest at the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. He spreads the message that despite common beliefs, violence and war are not inevitable, nor are they natural parts of the human condition.
In this clip, Paul offers a thought experiment. It can be difficult to listen to, as we said, but Paul offered it because he wanted to make a point about how war and violence become easier to accept when technology makes violence more impersonal. Let's listen.
I reference this book On Killing written by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, where he talks about how it is unnatural for humans to kill other humans. We actually have a natural aversion to killing our own species. And the evidence that we have to support this is all of military history, because in order to wage war, a country must dehumanize people. So I talk about how actually inflicting violence can be traumatic. Not only does kindness not traumatize us, while violence does traumatize us when it's against our will, but the act of inflicting violence can actually traumatize us, even if we receive no physical injury in the process. So I like to do this thought experiment to show how the act of committing violence can traumatize people. So I tell the audience, imagine that I ask you to spend the entire day with a 5-year-old girl, and your mission during this day is to get to know this 5-year-old girl as well as possible. Find out, what does she want to be when she grows up? Does she have a pet? What's her pet's name? What are her parents like? Does she have siblings? What are her siblings like? What's her favorite game? What are her interests, right? What's her favorite food? And then go to the park, spend the entire day getting to know this 5-year-old girl as well as possible. Now, at the end of this day, I want you to look the 5-year-old girl in the eyes, and without blinking or turning your head, I want you to take a hammer and bash her skull in. Around 98% of the human population will become traumatized from inflicting that intimate act of violence. But what if you don't spend the entire day with the 5-year-old girl? What if you know nothing about her and then you kill her? The percentage of people traumatized will decrease slightly. What if you never see her face? What if you hit her in the back of the head with a hammer? The percentage of people traumatized will decrease slightly. What if you don't use a hammer? What if you shoot her with a rifle at 300 yards? The percentage of people traumatized will decrease. What if you believe she's evil, or you believe her family's evil, or you believe her family's subhuman, or you believe that her family wants to kill your family? Percentage of people traumatized goes way down. What if you drop bombs at 10,000 feet? Percentage of people traumatized goes way down. And so the war system is able to create all these forms of distance. Some of these forms of distance are psychological in nature. Some of them are actually in terms of physical separation. And that is able to reduce the amount of people traumatized. Now, the human need to dehumanize people is so common that every culture that wants to kill people does this. The Nazis dehumanize people, the Ku Klux Klan, ISIS, Western governments, when they go to war, they dehumanize people. When somebody wants to kill a gay person, because that person is gay, they will dehumanize the person first. And the purpose of dehumanization is to protect the human mind from guilt and remorse. It allows you to hurt and kill humans without feeling remorseful about it. So if you look at the human condition, we actually have this biological aversion to hurting and killing humans, and dehumanization is needed to suppress that biological aversion.
That, though, makes me more concerned, because what Neil is saying is we're better able to kill without that personal tie.
Absolutely.
Right? With technology.
Yep. Absolutely.
And does that put us more at risk for perpetuating war, because it doesn't feel as traumatizing, it doesn't feel as personal?
Absolutely. The war system is this constantly evolving, adapting system. You make an advancement in moral progress, you make an advancement in empathy, and the war system adapts to it. So now the war system is adapting by using more drone strikes and more mechanization. So yes, he's absolutely right. So which means we have to continue our evolving and adapting to further push the system to where it can no longer harm innocent people.
Speaking of war, next we turn to Ken Burns, as co-director of a massive new project coming to PBS and WXXI-TV next month. It's a 10-part, 18-hour documentary series called The Vietnam War, and Lynn Novick was our guest.
Novick joined us to discuss how she and Burns decided to approach this project. They wanted to tell the complete story of the Vietnam War, and they believe that now is the right time to reevaluate what happened.
We usually want 25 years at least before we have any perspective on an event that would take us from the realm of journalism into the realm of history. When you're in the middle of something, it's very hard to know what's actually going on. And we have always felt the Vietnam War was signally important, perhaps the most important event in American history in the second half of the 20th century since World War II. But it's also because it was so traumatic and so complex, and it didn't end the way we hoped, and there was so much bad feeling and sort of bitterness about it, so much pain, that we never really took a hard look at what happened and why and who we should blame for what happened and what went wrong. And so we decided 10 years ago to take a fresh look at this story with the passage of time, as you say, and also was very important to us from the beginning that we would not try to look at the Vietnam War as a solely American experience, because too often when Americans talk about Vietnam, we're just talking about ourselves. And we didn't think it would be possible to understand any of the questions we wanted to look at if we didn't hear from Vietnamese as well.
You traveled to Vietnam and you had a chance to discuss the war and how it's impacting that society today. But I was struck by the fact that you said when you sort of look around, there's very little evidence that a war of that mm-hmm. scale happened, right?
Yeah, I made 3 trips to Vietnam. I'm about to go back again. And the thing, it is sort of striking that you just do not see evidence of the war around you when you think about the scale of devastation that happened there. It's remarkable how much has been sort of rebuilt or built over. But it's an incredibly resilient society. The people are hardworking and optimistic and forward-looking, and yet they're not unaffected by what happened there. So you sort of have to ask the right questions, and once you scratch the surface, there's a lot to be said and to be learned.
If you're wondering how Lynn and Ken decided to go about the process of gathering stories and telling stories, because in some ways 18 hours feels like you've given it a remarkable amount of time, but in other ways, Lynn, I am sure you cut stories that you couldn't believe you were going to end up leaving out, probably.
Yes, we did. That happens on every project, and it's sort of heartbreaking because people, and especially on this topic, everyone we spoke with was so generous and courageous to tell us their stories. And we did speak to thousands of people. We interviewed 100 people. There are 79 people that appear on screen in the film. And there's a great deal of material that's not included. But that said, you will meet quite an interesting and remarkable cast of characters over the course of these 18 hours. We have people who fought in the war, in the Marines, in the Army, in the Air Force. We have people who protested the war at home. We have Gold Star families. We have journalists. We have policy analysts. We have a doctor and a nurse, you know, a pretty wide range of perspectives on the American side. And then we also have in Vietnam civilians and combatants on the North and the South, the winning and the losing sides. And one of the things that really struck us over time was seeing that we can understand how the war was so controversial and complicated for Americans. It drove families apart. It drove our societies apart. It really, as one of our interviewees, a veteran, said, it drove a stake right in the heart of America. But it also caused a tremendous amount of inner conflict in people. So a number of soldiers that we spoke with, former soldiers, had really mixed feelings about their participation in the war. If they were drafted, they maybe didn't want to go, but they wanted to serve their country and do the honorable thing. But they really had mixed feelings about whether the war was right or winnable. Or there were soldiers who went over to Vietnam believing in everything they were told, and as soon as they got there, began to question the military's representation of the war or what they were being told by the leaders in Washington. So, you know, sometimes the film challenged our ideas about patriotism and courage. One of the veterans we spoke with, he wrestled with whether to go to Vietnam. He was drafted, and he really didn't feel that the war was right, but he was afraid to not go. And he said that is, for him, the act of cowardice. Going to Vietnam, you know, was not brave. That was the cowardly thing for him to do. So it's just, this is a deep and complicated story, and it raises all kinds of questions, some of which we can never answer.
Next, on the subject of documentaries, Al Gore is back in the national conversation. His 2006 film was called An Inconvenient Truth, and his new documentary is called An Inconvenient Sequel, and it's hitting theaters across the country, including here at The Little in Rochester.
We had the chance to talk to author Seamus McGraw, who wrote a book called Betting the Farm on a Drought, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change. McGraw heard from farmers who are conservative, they don't trust Al Gore, but they can no longer deny the reality of climate change.
You can make the argument that these are parts of natural cycles. In Texas, for example, there is a persistent and historic cycle of droughts. It is also pretty much undeniable at this point that the circumstances that contribute to those droughts are accelerating, that the droughts are coming closer together, and that they're becoming more severe. This is, at this stage of the game, the distinction between what portion of it is driven by a changing climate, and what portion of it is the conditions we've always faced, made worse not just by the changing climate, but by the number of people who are now in harm's way. You know, when you had the drought of record in Texas in the 1950s, the one that Elmer Kelton wrote about in The Time It Never Rained, a crippling, devastating drought, it was considered to be as bad as it could get. This last drought was, in some areas, worse, deeper, and in some cases almost as prolonged. There is little doubt among the people that study these things that in the very near future, and it seems to happen on 85-year cycles, a drought as bad as the drought of record is going to repeat, and that it's going to be augmented. At that stage of the game, when you're facing that kind of threat, which is really an existential threat, with that many more people who are potentially affected by it, I mean, you're talking about 15, 20 more people who are potentially in harm's way from that kind of a augmented natural cycle. The idea of getting into a pitched argument with the guy on the street about how much of it is climate and how much of it is natural, it's kind of a waste of time, isn't it? I mean, the reality is you've got a loaded gun pointed at your head, okay? Don't ask to see a receipt for the gun. Deal with the gun.
We're going to close on a lighter note. In this week's Summer of Food conversation, we posed the question, what is Rochester's food identity? And if James Beard were alive today, and if he were writing a new version of his classic book on American cookery, would he include a recipe for a garbage plate?
I've never had a garbage plate.
I don't want to oversimplify, but you could probably make your own version at home. There's lots of versions.
Oh, I will try it and report back.
Do it if you haven't eaten in like 4 days.
Well, Art Rogers is the owner and chef at Lento, and he's the only Rochester chef ever nominated for a James Beard Award. And while Rogers runs a high-end restaurant, he doesn't deny the garbage plate's place in Rochester's food culture.
I think it's an okay dish with an unfortunate name. I don't think there's anything wrong with the garbage plate per se as the dish. I mean, it's obviously not anything healthy like that, but I just wish it had a different name because, I don't know, I don't think you want food associated with garbage. At least I usually don't.
You know, one of the things that James Beard did in the late 60s when he was putting together his book American Cookery that ended up being 600-plus pages, 450 recipes, was he traveled and he thought about regional identity, and he included recipes from different regions after trying to kind of make some decisions on what, you know, is sort of valid when it comes to certain regional identities and what is not. So if you were undertaking that task today and you had to come up with a couple of recipes that were emblematic of Rochester, or at least I would say emblematic of Rochester and or emblematic of the potential of what we have here, what would you like to see in a book like that?
You know, I think if he was here, first of all, he absolutely would have a recipe for the garbage plate with the white hot. I've flipped through that book many times, his American Cookery, and just based on what he wrote in there, I don't think there's any doubt that he would have that in there, and he would write something funny about it as well as how it's connected to Rochester. But I think he would tie in the wineries of the Finger Lakes into what we have in Rochester. I feel like that's our largest claim to like the food and wine scene in our area, and focus on that. And then just, you know, we're a meat focused town, you know, with the hot dogs and the sausages. And I think he would just sort of pick from those sort of recipes and dishes that have been so prevalent and are, you know, still around with Zweigels and places like that.
But don't you think it's also possible, Art, that he would do that? He would have a garbage plate recipe, he would have some fun with that, but he would also then put the spotlight on the growing farm-to-table movement that's, you know, Lento's 10 years old now. You're the only James Beard-nominated chef in Rochester history. I would not be surprised if he then had a sort of a tip of the hat to this movement that's a decade old plus now in Rochester, and include some kind of a recipe that's closer to, you know, sort of the spirit of Lento. I mean, what kind of recipe would you love to see him grab, either kind of based on what you're doing, or, you know, if you had the chance to kind of drop a recipe for it?
I think if he did something, we have so much great produce grown, you know, not only just in Monroe County, but obviously in all the surrounding counties. Just some sort of height of summer salad showcasing all the amazing produce that we have, especially, you know, right now. I know it's a little bit behind with the wet spring, but normally this time of the year, it's, you know, tomatoes, anything from tomatoes to beets and all the amazing greens that are out right now. And maybe showcasing a few of the local farms and the things that they grow so well, just something put together really simply with everything being grown, you know, right here. I mean, you could do it almost 100%, or you probably could do it 100%.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM, WEOS.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.